13. Characteristics of Byron. He was anxious to show you that he possessed no Shakespeare or Milton, because, he said, I have been accused of borrowing from them. He affected to doubt whether Shakespeare was so great a genius as he has been taken for, and whether fashion had not a great deal to do with it. Spenser he could not read, at least he said so. All the gusto of that most poetical of the poets went with him for nothing. I lent him a volume of The Faerie Queen, and he said he would try to like it. Next day he brought it to my study window and said, Here, Hunt, here is your Spenser. I cannot see anything in him. And he seemed anxious that I should take it out of his hands, as if he was afraid of being accused of copying so poor a writer. That he saw nothing in Spenser is not likely, but I really do not think that he saw much. Spenser was too much out of the world, and he too much in it. He would make confessions of vanity or some other faults, or of inaptitude for a particular species of writing, partly to sound what you thought of it, partly that while you gave him credit for the humility, you were to protest against the concession. All the perversity of his spoiled nature would then come into play, and it was in these and similar perplexities that the main difficulty of living with him consisted. If you made everything tell in his favour, as most people did, he was pleased with you for not differing with him. But then nothing was gained. He lumped you with the rest, and was prepared to think as little of you in the particular as he did of anyone else. If you contested a claim or allowed him to be right in a concession, he could neither argue the point nor readily concede it. He was only mortified, and would take his revenge. Lastly, if you behaved like his admirers in general, in a sulky or disputatious manner, but naturally, and as if you had a right to your jest and your independence, whether differ or admire, and apart from an eternal consideration for himself, he thought it an assumption, and would perplex you with all the airs and humours of an insulted beauty, then nobody could rely for a comfortable intercourse with him, either upon admissions or non-admissions, or even upon flattery itself. An immeasurable vanity kept even his adorers at a distance, like Xerxes enthroned with his millions a mile off. And if, in a fit of desperation, he condescended to come close, and he, fond, he laughed at you for thinking you were of consequence to him, if you were taken in, and hated you if you stood out, which was to think yourself of great consequence. Neither would acknowledge of all this, if you made him conscious, have lowered his self-admiration a jot. He would have thought it the mark of a great man, a noble capriciousness, an evidence of power, which none but the Alexanders and Napoleons of the intellectual world could venture upon. Mr. Hazlitt had some reason to call him a sublime coxcomb. Who but he, or Rochester perhaps, whom he resembled, would have thought of avoiding Shakespeare, lest he should be thought to owe him anything? And talking of Napoleon, he delighted when he took the additional name of Noel, in consequence of his marriage with an heiress, to sign himself N.B. Because, said he, Bonaparte and I are the only public persons whose initials are the same. By Leigh Hunt.